Session number 13242, Reel 4.
Mr. Walton, Reel 4.
As we said, when the boat came alongside, the scrambling nets were down, and one or two of our survivors there made a leap and a grab for the scrambling nets, but there was one of the firemen there who, as he grabbed, the boat came up on the surge of the wave, and it crashed against the rescue ship's side, and his head was crushed like a tomato. But for myself, I couldn't climb, I couldn't walk, I couldn't lift myself through they call it hypothermia today, I suppose it was then, but we didn't get told a lot of things then. Anyway, a rope came down and it was put underneath my armpits, and I was hoisted up on deck of this the Gotland there. And when I got up there, two people put their arms under my shoulder, under my armpits, and helped me along the deck down into the fog of the below decks there, the accommodation, which had to be very limited by reason of, you know, for get as many men aboard as possible. And there was an able sick berth attendant, I remember him to this day, who kind of stripped my wet gear off me and toweled me down with a big rough Turkish towel, and just about took the skin off me, and I was cursing and swearing. And just to help matters, I suppose, might be a wrong thing, but I was given half a tumbler full of neat Puss's rum. And as fast as that rum went down, it came back. And whenever I touch rum this day and age, I can still think of those days. Anyway, we had on this rescue ship by then, we'd quite a number of survivors from other ships. And it was a bit naughty, because if she had been torpedoed or in any bother, any trouble at all, the survivors would have rushed the lifeboats. That was what the mates on the Curry's boat on the Gotland were rather frightened of. And the Yankee survivors, my goodness me, talk about Uncle Sam, they had their survival suits on. Well, their survival suits were in one piece, which they could step into with their shoes shiny and their nice, pristine uniforms, whatever, just pull the zip up, it fitted tightly around the neck there, and when they were hauled aboard, they just stepped out of these things with their shoes still shining, and there we were. And one of these Americans gave me one when we got to Greenock as a souvenir. But going back to the rescue ship, well, everybody stood all kinds of watchers and the rest of it, but there was a German submarine at the time when the searchlights were playing on the water to pick us up and everything. She was seen over to on the starboard side just watching what was going on, and she didn't interfere at all. And so much for the propaganda about the Germans. But the next day there was quite a bit of fog and mist and everything, and we saw this German submarine ahead of us. We were still hunting for more survivors, and she just slid under the surface like a big grey whale. And the rescue ships, of course, at that time were fitted with the very latest Hufduff, the HFDF, where they could, in conjunction with the escort group, they could pick up the German submarines, because one of the Germans had an awful fault during the war. Must have helped our people out no end. But they used to transmit their position and have signals sent to them all day and night. And of course, Hufduff would pick them up, and they'd find out the location of the U-boat. Anyway, fortunately, there was an outward-bound convoy, westbound, and the Germans gave their attention to that. Not that we were very sorry. So eventually, we, the usual thing, round the Instrahull in the north of Ireland, and off Skerryvore round the Mull of Kintyre, and up to Gourock there, where as survivors we were landed ashore. And also there were a load of the dear old Scots ladies there who were watching us come ashore. They thought we were U-boat prisoners because they were shaking the fists at us and spitting and whatnot, and we thought, well, how little do you know? Anyway, we were clad in all kinds of odds and sods of bits of uniform and whatnot, and we were fitted out with some things if you wanted to be, kind of very garish sports coats and rescue. They did, they mustn't be ungrateful. But I wanted to get home as quick as I could, and I got up to Glasgow there and down to Preston, where I changed trains to go home to Blackpool. And I remember sitting in the train at the time, and my hair was still kind of matted in fuel oil, and I looked, well, in scruff order, to say the least. And there was a businessman and his secretary sitting in the coach, who seemed to be highly amused by the way I was dressed. So I told them in the shut up. So that was that. And when I got home, the first thing my sister said to me, the telegram from the company hadn't arrived home, and it arrived the next day. And my sister said to me, where do you think you've been? And I told her and what had happened. Oh, no, 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 she said, I know. She said, that silver cigarette case, she said, you must have sold it for drink. Because she believed in the principle that when my brother and myself came home, instead of going round the local pub for a wet, that we should read a good book. We got enough time for reading at sea. And then I had another month's survivor's leave.
Can I just ask you at this stage what your own attitude in the war was towards the U-boat crews?
Well, I think it was that it was still in some ways a great adventure. And then they had a job to do, we had a job to do, we were professional sailors, and they were professional sailors. And I think the hatred came into the war with propaganda. Well, if you were sailors of international, and you know, it was I don't say you exalted and shriek your head off if a German submarine was sunk, or it was just to the merchant service. I think it was an everyday job. It was just a job that had to be done. There weren't an awful lot of heroics about it. You were seamen.
So there was no hatred of the U-boat crews?
Not really, no. Not really. I can't say you didn't want to meet them, you didn't want to see them, but I wouldn't say you would have picked them up had you the opportunity of doing so.
You would have picked them up?
Yes. Mind you, there again, it's over 50 years ago. My thoughts might have mellowed an awful lot. The part of Germany that I couldn't fathom out, I couldn't stand, I would have hated, were the people like the brown shirts and the SS and the Gestapo and propaganda people like that who, no, seamen, I think, were doing a job.
So you said you'd come home for survivor's leave.
Yes.
What happened to you after that?
Well, then I was once again back to the pool, and I was signed on an LSTST-10, which is a landing ship tank, one that was being built over in the States. There were quite a few of them to be brought over to this country ready for the invasion.
LST-10,
a landing ship tank. And she was being built. I was signed on as a third mate, but I was a fortnight on articles for which we were paid, but we never sailed. The Royal Navy eventually picked them up in the States and brought them over to they'd be ready for the North African landings.
So you never did it?
No, we didn't do it. And then it was a case of hanging around. Well, you had to be a bit suspicious of the pool, because you could be landed on any old ship, and some ships, truthfully, weren't fit to sail. You might... Well, literally, you could be sent anywhere. You could refuse one ship, and I think it was one ship, and after that you had to take the next one. But there in the shipping office at Cornhill there in Liverpool was this advert on the, this poster on the wall for one of the Admiralty agreements. They had T-124T, T-124X, T-124. They were all for merchant service people to transfer over into the R&R and become sail under the White Ensign with... under the Naval Discipline Act. And so T-124T was were rescue tugs, and I volunteered for this, and I was sent down to the Queen Anne's Mansions there in London for my medical. Well, having a left leg that was an inch and a half shorter than the other due to my having gone down the number one hold on my first trip, and having a perforated eardrum, I still managed to pass the medical, which goes to show they were short of men. If I had wanted to, I could have had the opportunity to be invalided out, but who on earth would do that? Because you were a seaman, you were a professional seaman, that was your job. And there was a war on, you'd seen the beginning of the war, and without any heroics, you meant to see the end of it, God be willing. It would have been a hateful prospect to have seen all your friends and your mates and people you knew, to see them still carrying on and you having to have been invalided out of it. So you put on a brave face, and I got through the medical, and I was accepted, and I went up to Campbelltown on the Mullican Tyre, HMS Nimrod, which was the ASDIC training school, but it was also a rescue tug base. Rescue tugs had been formed, early part of 1940. They did some wonderful work during the war, but not an awful lot has been publicised about it. They were very much a Harry Tate's Navy. They, like submarines in the Navy, they were pushed in the dirtiest corner of the dockyard, out of sight of everybody. And there we were. Well, when I went up to Campbelltown there, resplendent in my sub-lieutenant's uniform and whatnot, my first tug was the Growler. Then I was on the Bustler, but I was just spare crew, because they used to lie at the jetty there in Campbelltown and just wait for... they had their radios on all the time. They kept a constant radio watch for ships out in distress or whatever. And the first time I went out was in the Bustler, and Tim Bond, Lieutenant Commander Bond, finished up as a commander at the end of the war, He was from Hull. He was with United Towing before the war, and of course he knew the job inside out. But the British knew very little about towing. It all had to be picked up. It all had to be learnt by experience. We had one or two fishermen amongst the crew, yachtsmen, and the rest were professional merchant seamen. And they, you know, people with a good knowledge of seamanship, a good basic knowledge of seamanship. And the first time I went aboard the Bustler there was to pick up the ship. She was one of Asiatic Steamship Company, the Begum. It was 300 miles out in the Western Ocean, and she'd lost a propeller. Of course, that we were rubbing our hands with glee, because that was a marine risk, and then we would get salvage money, of course, when we got her in. So we found her eventually, and it was very rough weather. We managed to get a line aboard her, and we towed her back, and we towed her into Ross Sea and tied up alongside, had a party aboard, and that was it. When my share of the salvage money eventually came, much later in the war, I think it was a 6 share, would be about £169, which was a lot of money in those days. Quite a lot of money.
Was this HMS Bustler?
Bustler, yes. The Bustler class were the Bustler, Growler, Samsonia. And the last one they built, the Hesperia. And the last one they... There was one war loss, that was the Hesperia. She was riven ashore in North Africa. She towed, she was towing a dry dock, I think, at the time, but she went ashore. She was a total loss. From then I was going to they had, these tugs were stationed at Falmouth, naturally, and Londonderry, and Campbelltown, but we also had them in Gibraltar. We had them all over the, they were beginning to put them all over the world. Freetown, the Dutch mainly did Freetown in the Swartzee and the Nord Sea. They were all called after seas, the Dutch tug Smits. And when I went on my first leave from the Bustler there, I was in the Growler and the Samsonia, but when I went on my first leave from the Bustler, we Campbelltown, as I said before, it was the Asdic school, and they had the two hotels ashore, the Argyle and the Royal, and of course the Argyle was a wardroom, and you would get the submariners in there. They were quite sociable, but the straight RN, the straight-laced RN, they didn't want to know, really. I mean, we were just an intrusion into their private navy. And we, our ratings used to go for route marches with a bagpiper at the head of them. And it was my first occasion that took my memory back to the Empire Mersey, when I attended the rum issue. And being an officer, being the officer of the day there at the time, a rum person was dishing out the tots of rum, and he said a sly aside to me, "Are you for a tot yourself, you see, sir?" So I said, "Yes, go on." So of course he looked around, there was nobody coming, so I got a tot of rum, and that gave him, he was ad lib, he could do anything after that, because I'd broken the rules, as it were. But we had a certain Captain Farker there at the time, who used to come up to young sub-lieutenants and whatnot after the rum issue, and put his face very near to theirs and ask them questions. Of course, when they replied, he could smell the rum a mile away. But anyway, going back, I went on leave, and I came back up to Greenock to join one of the new, a brand new Admiralty, BAT, British Admiralty tug. She'd been built in Bay City in Michigan, the Aimwell. And the Aimwell was a diesel-electric tug. Well, diesel-electric was something entirely new in those days. And she was armed with...
These are all HMS, are they?
Yes, these are all HMS. Oh, yes, they're not. They weren't dockyard tugs or anything like that. I mean, they were deep-sea tugs. And the...
What date have we reached now?
We're now in 1943.
When did you rescue the Begum?
The Begum.
In 43,
yeah, about February, March time, 43. March time, 43. It was very the Mad March days.
And it was called the HMS Aimwell?
Aimwell, yes, AIMWELL. And they were built in Bay City in Michigan. Near Chicago, and of course they had to come down the Great Lakes and whatnot. They had a passage crew to bring them over from the States. They were commissioned over in America, but I joined her up in Greenock there, and we were due... we didn't know where we were going, truthfully. And we stored the ship there at Greenock, and off we went. We joined a convoys and an additional escort. We just tagged the stern of a convoy. And we went into Gibraltar. And in Gib, of course, at that time, Anzio, the battle for landings in Italy, were going ahead in full. And the Warspite, she had just come in. She'd been towed in by some one or two of our people from Anzio. They'd had a glider bomb in the boiler room, in one of the boiler rooms, and it had exploded. I think about 5 ratings were killed. She was in dry dock, and they were taking the bodies out. And they, in Gib during the war, of course, no naval ratings were buried ashore. They were all buried at sea. And the duty trawler used to go out most mornings when they had any funeral service to carry out. And kind of slipped the bodies over the side off Dead Man's Bay, Europa Point there. And they when we went into Gib there, of course, spirits and whatnot for the bond, they were in rather short supply. Zirconian speed, we couldn't get much there, so we did hear that the Warspite was decommissioning and coming back to UK for a refit, and they were selling off all the wardroom supplies and whatnot. And if you bought a case of gin, you also had to take a case of this crusted vermouth. And this crusted vermouth, it must have been lying in the bowels of the Warspite for years, and together with gin, it made a very pernicious drink, to say the least. Anyway, from Gib, we went on to Mers El Kebir, over in near Iran, of course, where the wrecks of the French men of war after the British, of course, had bombarded the French fleet in there, some of the wrecks were still there. And the French, well, they had no time at all for us there. And we lay there for about 5 days, just waiting, wondering what to do. There was nobody came to see us. We'd no signals, we'd nothing. Until one day, a rather eccentric Captain RN came wandering down, and he'd seen a white ensign flying in the port, and he wanted to know what ship it was, what was she doing there. And when he came aboard, he said, the Aimwell. That's the one we've been looking for. She's been lost. Nobody knows where she's got to, but of course the signal system, as I suppose, was a bit chaotic at the time. And from there we carried on our voyage the rest of it to Trincomalee, where we were going in Ceylon to be based at Trinco with the Eastern Fleet. Well, we of course went called in at Portside and Aden, and I also remember going through the Suez Canal. The banks at that time were lined with, every so many hundred yards or so, they had Bofors guns and whatnot, anti-aircraft guns against the German planes bombing or laying mines in the canal. And they had the soldiers there, the Royal Artillery, I suppose, by these guns. And the sun was shining, we had the awnings rigged, and we were playing music over the loud halo. I was the officer of the watch at the time, and I remember we were playing over the loud halo White Christmas, Bing Crosby, when it first came out. And I said, spoke over in the loud halo to one of these swaddies on the shore, and I said, "What price of White Christmas now?" And this bloke just stooped his hands down into the sand, and he grabbed up two big handfuls of sand and just let them dribble through his fingers, and then he gave me a very smart V for victory, and that was that. But so we eventually get to Ceylon, to Trincomalee. That's back where I was, where I'd wished many moons ago that I could be stationed for the rest of the war. Well, I was, and I can't say we saw the build-up of the fleet. The in Trincomalee Harbour at that time, there was a big a wreck of one of Paddy Henderson's. I had my notes with me, I could tell you, but she was she'd been bombed and set on fire there, and she was beached. And the small boats used to do boiler cleans alongside her. Anyway, we just lay swinging round a buoy most of the time, and it was a very hard job with, you know, a small ship, small crew, keeping them gainfully employed to stop them becoming bored to tears. I felt sorry for them on, you know, many occasions.
Wasn't there any rescue work for the tug to do?
No, not at the time, because the Japanese presence in the Indian Ocean was very little, really. There was one or two scares, but we had expected to have the Eastern Fleet going on sweeps to Dubai, Sabang and Sumatra there, Palembang and whatnot. We had expected them ships to be damaged and for us to go out and tow them in. We, if you can imagine Trincomalee Harbour at that time, they had some 36,000 naval personnel afloat, let alone ashore. And we had the Americans in the goodness me, what's the American carrier? I'll come back to that in a minute. But we had the French battleship, the Richelieu. We had the Italian sloop, the Eritrea. The Eritrea had been based on Singapore, working with the Japanese. When Italy came out of the war, when she became allied to us, they slit the throats of two Japanese who were aboard and chucked them over the side and made their getaway and came back to she was escorted back into Trinco, and there she used to rendezvous with the submarines and bring them back in. And